Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States. Episode 4.35, Reconciliation or Independency. As the colonies approached the first anniversary of the beginning of hostilities at Lexington and Concord, it is hard for us not to reflect on the events thus far. Throughout the colonies, there had been a sense that war was inevitable in the months leading up to that fateful confrontation on Lexington Green. By the end of 1774, the British were seeing more and more of their meaningful ability to govern the colonists erode away. Yet, at the same time, the Battle of Lexington and Concord did come as something of a surprise. For those delegates heading to the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia, they had no idea that from their arrival they would find themselves unexpectedly thrust into the position of being a de facto wartime government. Throughout the remainder of the year, and on past the winter of 1776, the colonies found themselves in a far different place than they had been on the eve of that first battle. Now that Boston was in the hands of the Americans, they were left to figure out what the next phase of the war was. Thus far, the war had largely been contained to New England. Yes, there had been some limited action elsewhere. Charlestown had been shelled to begin the year. There was fighting up in Quebec. Not to mention a handful of other minor skirmishes. However, to this point in the war, it had largely remained contained in New England. Or, to be even more specific, to Boston. With the British withdrawal from Boston, there was little question over what their next destination would be. From essentially the minute of the evacuation, Washington began shifting men and supplies to the south for what seemed like an inevitable collision in New York. In the southern colonies, there were repeated threats from the British to incite slave rebellions and Indian uprisings, which had managed to help ensure that the southern colonies were just as much in on the war as were the northern colonies. These were not mere rumors either, as good evidence existed that the British were indeed attempting to do exactly what the colonists feared. Of course, this would all be officially confirmed when in November, Governor Dunmore went ahead and officially announced his proclamation to emancipate any enslaved person who agreed to join the British fight. This, when combined with the fighting in New England, assured that by the time we reach the evacuation of Boston in March 1776, we are truly dealing with united colonies. As the campaign season of 1776 approached, the British were coming with a plan which they hoped would turn the tide of the conflict. No longer just reacting to events as they happened, the British were now looking to take control and snuff out the rebellion once and for all. The plan for the British involved three main prongs. As George Washington had correctly predicted, William Howe was planning to move from Halifax to New York. For the British, the real victory in New York was not control of Manhattan itself, but rather control of the all-important Hudson Bay. Control over the Hudson opened up the possibility of running all the way north, through Lake George and Lake Champlain, and eventually into the St. Lawrence. Should the British be able to gain control over the Hudson, they could effectively isolate New England from everybody else. Howe did not just plan an assault on New York, however, and sent John Burgoyne, along with 6,000 men, to take control of Quebec. It was a plan that was reminiscent of Geoffrey Amherst's plan, years before during the French and Indian War. If you will recall, in that conflict, men starting out at Fort William Henry were to move up past Fort Ticonderoga, Crown Point, and Montreal, before joining up with an army moving south from Louisbourg to Quebec. Ultimately, the plan was for the two armies to come together and move jointly on the Canadian capital. Of course, that is not what happened. There, the ultimate joining of the forces came at Montreal, not Quebec. This would ultimately end up resulting in the French capitulating Canada. The British were now planning much the same, with Howe moving to the north and Burgoyne moving from the south, until such a time that they would meet up, severing New England from the rest of the colonies. The British had likewise not forgotten that the southern colonies existed. The job of subduing them fell to Henry Clinton. Clinton would head to the South, cause as much havoc as he could, before booking it back north during the summer of 1776 to help Howe in New York. The British plan for 1776 was set, and it was going to be up to George Washington and company to stymie those ambitions. We will, of course, talk about all of this going forward. However, this episode is about an entirely different battle. The war had been going on for nearly a year now. Yet, even after all of this time, there remained that critical question. What were they fighting for? What was the end goal of all of this bloodshed? Does the colonial leadership still believe that reconciliation is possible? And even if it is it what anybody wants anymore? Or was the solution something far more dramatic and permanent? From essentially the very beginning of the war, right in the aftermath of Lexington and Concord, questions as to the war's ultimate goals were circulating. Although it was little secret that the likes of Sam and John Adams supported independence. The first time that the subject appeared in Congress came from South Carolina's John Rutledge. On May 16, 1775, as debates over the creation of the Continental Army were ongoing, Rutledge asked the critical question, "What are we doing here?" Rutledge wanted to know if the end goal of the fighting was independence, or if it was still reconciliation, and the crown addressing the grievances of the colonies. Still, however, in May 1775, the idea of independence was seen as being a radical outcome that made many of the delegates uncomfortably squeamish. We have talked about this in detail already. However, by the time we reached the spring of 1776, much had changed. More blood had spilled in both Bunker Hill and in Canada. The Americans had forced the British out of Boston. In the South, British machinations towards widespread emancipation of the slaves, plus the courting of the Native Americans, had done much to convince those colonists that reconciliation may not be possible. Despite his best efforts, Dickinson's Olive Branch petition from July 1775 had been completely ignored by George III. Without anything resembling consideration. It was not simply either that George III was unwilling to consider the American petition. Prior to him ignoring it, he had in August 1775 declared that the colonies as a whole were in a state of rebellion. Going further, his proclamation was that the sole goal of the colonies was the founding of an independent empire. Something which he was determined to crush by decisive means. George went a step further, indicating that he was open to using foreign assistance to execute the war, something that, as we will see momentarily, was more than a mere threat. To this point, the colonists had gone out of their way to establish that they were not looking at independence, and that the entire conflict was because they wanted their rights as Englishmen to be respected. However, for reasons of likely garnering support, that was not the story the king was presenting. Clearly, therefore, all throughout 1775, tensions had been building, and meaningful hope of reconciliation was fading. This would become more pronounced with the December 22nd passage of the Prohibitory Act. The Prohibitory Act was a restriction put into place that stated that the British could seize all American ships, as well as any ship caught trading with America, and sell them off. Americans on board those ships would then be impressed into the Royal Navy. In other words, the British had set up a blockade of the entirety of the colonies. America still lacked anything really resembling a navy at this junction. However, privateers were causing British ships off the coast more than a few headaches. The Prohibitory Act now subjected those privateers and any non-privateers to being forced into the Royal Navy. Furthermore, it completely cut off the hopes of trade from other European nations, as the seizure of ships made the risk more than anybody was really willing to accept. news of the king's statements of the colonies being in rebellion and the passage of the Prohibitory Acts made their way into the colonies in January and February 1776. The news was therefore hitting right at the same time that Thomas Paine's Common Sense was spreading like wildfire throughout the colonies. This confluence of events had a dual effect. It both made the idea of reconciliation seem more unlikely as a practical matter, but at the same time, it made reconciliation seem far less desirable than it had been at the start of the war. John Adams is quoted as saying that the Prohibitory Act should have been called the Act of Independency. This is because the act went such a long ways at essentially tying the hands of the Americans. With reconciliation now looking less and less like a probable outcome, the question therefore becomes, what remains holding the colonists back from the option of independence? Among the biggest concerns of those now looking at the possibility came a reluctance to form a republic, as some of the more radicals, like Thomas Paine, were advocating for. For all we celebrate the founding generation today for forming a democratic system, it was not a decision that they would reach lightly. Indeed, for many, the idea of republicanism brought with it the fear of chaos and a government that was subject to the whims of popular will. In the southern colonies, there was among many the feeling that the New England colonies were born out of radicalism, and now they were threatening to take the rest of the colonies with them. Washington himself recognized this problem, believing that much of the popular resistance to independence was fear over democracy. John Adams, who was firmly in the independence camp and had been for a while, likewise found the position of Thomas Paine to be far too radical for his taste. What Adams instead favored was a government that would see a bicameral legislature with a lower house that was popularly elected. However, without direct election of either the upper house or the executive. Differences aside, however, by the time May 1776 rolled around, it was becoming increasingly clear that this question as to what they were all doing needed to be answered. During the latter stages of the imperial crisis, we saw the effective breakdown of British governance over the colonies. Although the collapse of British control had been a completely transformative event just 18 months earlier, now it was becoming a liability. British control was very much gone by this point. However, that meant that the colonies were acting in a manner that was dangerously pell-mell when it came to conducting their business. For the contingent that was advocating independence, this proved to be a boon. It was now possible to argue that rather than being a radical departure from accepted norms, independence offered the colonies a way to restore that order that had been lost with the collapse of British control. Should the colonies declare their independence, they could then take up the mantle of leadership. This would mean the establishment of an official government, reopening those courts that had been closed for over a year, and establishing trade independent of the British. Should, on the other hand, the colonies choose to stay the course, with, what was being argued to be delusional, a hope of reconciliation, there remained a real risk of societal breakdown and anarchy. For a society that was very much in favor of order, this was an extremely persuasive argument. The risks to the stability of the movement were far more powerful than mere fear-mongering as well. The Prohibitory Acts were a real problem for the colonies. Despite the relative newness of the act, it isn't as though trade had not long since dried up. The war was causing widespread shortages throughout the colonies. What supplies did exist quickly became far more expensive as demand surged and supply plummeted. Great Britain had enemies, most notably France, who were still smarting from their sound defeat a decade earlier during the Seven Years' War. should the Americans declare independence. It would open up avenues of trade between the colonies and Britain's enemies, who were ever eager to stick it to London. Although it should be noted that the colonists were not exactly wanting French troops in the colonies either. There was still a lot of bad blood after spending the last half century fighting them. Despite not wanting to get too friendly at this stage, they were certainly not opposed to the potential risk that the French would pose for the British holdings in the Caribbean, and potentially back across the Atlantic in Europe. If French machinations could force London to divert resources, literally anywhere else, that was a pretty good sounding prospect. French involvement in the war was more than a distant pipe dream, too. By the time the delegates were beginning to address questions over independence, the French were already covertly shipping arms to the Americans in exchange for tobacco. In the early spring of 1776, the colonists agreed to open up trade with the rest of the world. This was, according to historian Robert Middlecoff, a signal that the colonies had finally cleared that hurdle and realized that independence was not merely just an option, but really, by that spring, it had become the only option. During the coming weeks, several of the colonies would begin giving instructions, though often vague, that more or less gave their delegates the okay to proceed forward with independence. By this point, even Georgia, whom had long been the most reluctant colony, sent instructions that freed its delegates to vote for independence. Most dramatically, Rhode Island just went ahead and declared its independence, while giving instructions for the colony to join in with the other colonies in a common government. By May, the colonists were further hearing rumors that a British army, an army that was filled with German mercenaries, was sailing across the Atlantic to crush the rebellion. It was clear to everybody that there would be no negotiating out of this, and on May 10th, Congress recommended to the United Colonies that the time was now to begin the process of establishing governments for both their local constituents as well as for America in general. Congress was openly stating that the individual colonies needed to begin the process of reestablishing order, while at the same time, the colonies as a united entity needed to do the same. Congress then established a committee consisting of John Adams, Richard Henry Lee, and Edward Rutledge to write a preface for the resolution. The preface that they produced was the most direct denunciation of the Crown thus far. It outright stated that by his acquiescence to the Acts of Parliament, the King had excluded the colonies from his protection. It called George III out for ignoring the pleas of the colonies and sending over a foreign army, an army made up of mercenaries, to destroy those same colonies. The preface states, "It appears absolutely irreconcilable to reason and good conscience for the people of these colonies now to take oaths and affirmation necessary for the support of any government under the Crown of Great Britain. And it is necessary that the exercise of every kind of authority under the said crown should be totally suppressed, and all powers of government exerted under the authority of the people of the colonies." This preface was completed and submitted on May 13th. However, it was not approved until May 15th, as several days of debate ensued. When it did pass, it was not a unanimous vote either, with at least four colonies voting against the resolution, with as many as two others abstaining. Although the resolution had passed, this was clearly not the mandate that they would have hoped for. The question therefore shifts to why. As we have spent the first half of the episode discussing, there was popular support for such measures. Seemingly everybody knew by this point that the winds were unmistakably blowing in the direction of independence. So why the reluctance when it came to approving directions for the colonies to pursue that very thing? First, the preface had gone considerably further than the original resolution had proposed. As we talked about a little while ago, there was a real apprehension throughout the colonies over the formation of a republic. The delegates were all well-versed in the classics and could hearken back to Greek republics and, most specifically, the Roman Republic, and ask themselves just how those had worked out. Despotism of the many could be just as bad as despotism of one. Knowing this, when Adams and company had included that line in the preface, that the colonists should suppress the authority of the crown and transfer those powers to the people of the colonies, that was a radical suggestion that sent a shockwave of unease through the Congress. Critically, it is important to understand that the preface was not a declaration of independence. It openly stated what the colonies should do, what they needed to consider. However, it did not take that critical step of actually declaring independence. What it did do, however, is help to break that final tie with Great Britain. Throughout the entire imperial crisis, and even as recently as the Olive Branch Petition, the colonists had viewed Parliament as the enemy. They had appealed to the crown for protection from a rogue Parliament. However, now they are acknowledging the fact that King George III was complicit in their subjugation. He was not planning to offer them protection from a parliamentary overstep. No, what he was planning on doing was sending an army across the Atlantic to smash their resistance. At the same time, in the middle of May, is when the colonists received credible evidence that the British were indeed sending an army of German mercenaries to the colonies. At that same exact moment, the delegates were also learning that the situation in Canada was worsening, as a British fleet had arrived. Meanwhile, even within London, where those who were still sympathetic to the American cause attempted to broker a peace, found themselves firmly rejected. The king had decided that the only option that he was going to consider was the military option. Well, unease still did exist, as illustrated by the tepid response to the May 15th preface. Within a few weeks, by the end of May, the news had firmly shifted the power completely into the hands of the radicals. There would, of course, remain questions about the government to be formed, questions that are going to remain intact for the coming decades. However, by the start of June 1776, it was abundantly clear to everybody that there was no avenue to reconciliation, and that independence was the only option. Historian Woody Holton writes in his book, Liberty is Sweet, The Hidden History of the American Revolution, that nobody did more for the cause of independence than the British. The link between independence and republicanism was absolutely a major impediment to the cause of independence. However, time and time again, British actions worked to keep the Americans united and sway those who were still skeptical towards the necessity of breaking from the British. Paulina Meyer, in her book American Scripture, would further state that by the beginning of June, even Robert Morris, who had been amongst the most reluctant to declare independence, acquiesced to the fact that independence was inevitable, acknowledging that Great Britain had brought this on itself. I want to finish up today by heading back a bit and looking at some of the fantastic scholarship by Paulina Meyer in her book American Scripture. One of the things that Meyer looks at is the fact that the driving force behind the eventual declaration did not occur exclusively in Philadelphia, but was rather something that took place throughout the colonies. We have already talked some about this, but I want to go into a bit more detail of just how this change came about. First, it is important that we fully understand how the Continental Congress largely worked, especially when it came to the big issues. Rather than delegates having the unbridled freedom to do what they wanted, they oftentimes were operating on instructions from their colonial assemblies. The colonial assemblies likewise were controlled by the freemen, whom they were elected by. Therefore, the decision for independence did not come from a Pennsylvania statehouse, but rather it came from a grassroots effort of counties inside of the individual colonies. Those colonial assemblies then made up the recommendation of what the congressional delegates could and could not do. As a result of the debates, there are over 90 known documents that provided those necessary instructions that independence should be sought. Most of these documents came from individual towns, instructing their representative to the colonial assembly how to vote. These 90 declarations are, to be fair, not evenly spaced out. New England, and in what I'm sure is not a surprise to all of you, Massachusetts in particular, led the way. Massachusetts was something of a unique case. Again, it probably is not a surprise if you have been following along that Massachusetts was among the leaders of the radical element in Congress pushing for independence. Well before 1776, they had the green light to vote for independence. And with men like the two Adams and John Hancock, it is the outcome that they clearly sought. So then why have another constitutional debate at the colonial level to decide the question? The hope was that a rousing response in Massachusetts would serve as an example to the more hesitant middle colonies and would push them over the edge and firmly into the camp of independence. The debate, however, by this point had largely shifted. Even in the colonies that were more reluctant to declare independence, particularly in the middle colonies such as New York, Maryland, and Pennsylvania, the conversation had moved from the inevitability of independence onto the question of timing. Now, I'm going to leave the actual debates over independence for the next episode. However, by June, it is safe to say that throughout the colonies, it was abundantly clear that independence was coming, and it was just a matter of when and how. Ironically, this actually did not have the intended outcome. Sure, the major population centers were firmly in favor of independence. What the Massachusetts leadership, however, wanted was a near unanimous vote of confidence in independence from everybody. This meant moving beyond the major towns and into the more rural parts of the colony. It was here where enthusiasm for independence was less than what the leadership was hoping for. In many of these small towns, they simply had never debated an issue anywhere near on par with the question of independence, throwing them into deep debate over the question. Now, at the end of the day, Massachusetts was overwhelmingly in favor of independence. But the unexpectedly slow response illustrates that even though popular sentiment was swinging in the direction of independence, it was still not exactly a universal mandate. This hesitation failed to inspire confidence in the middle colonies. Rather, the push that they needed came not from the north, but rather from the south, with Virginia leading the charge. During elections in early April, the freemen of Virginia overwhelmingly voted in favor of a break with Great Britain. The colonies saw widespread turnover, with nearly one-third of the counties replacing their representatives. Almost universally, these elections were replacing the conservative members with men who were going to be willing to vote for separation. Not everybody was a fan of this. In Virginia, the leading conservative, Landon Carter, lamented on the fact that even family members of some of the more conservative members came out and voted for their removal, claiming that it made the entire thing a farce. Despite some misgivings, ironically by Patrick Henry, the message from Virginia was clear. Not only did they approve their delegates to support independence, but they urged their delegates to formally propose independence. This sent a shockwave through those colonies that were still sitting on the fence. New Jersey would follow suit a few weeks later, influenced by a mixture of the Virginia resolution and the worsening military situation. Not only did they approve their delegation to support independence, but they also went ahead and arrested their colonial governor, William Franklin. Pennsylvania remained a huge problem. especially when the more conservative assembly survived an early May election. However, shortly after that first election, news of German mercenaries and an engagement in the Delaware River made them begin to question their earlier choices. This very nearly led to a mini-revolution within Pennsylvania itself, as more radical elements made an attempt in late May to overthrow the existing colonial government, using the preamble from the May 15th resolution as their justification. The established assembly attempted to save itself by changing its instructions on June 8th to allow the delegation to vote for independence. However, it was too late, as support rapidly eroded away from the old assembly. By June 14th, they no longer had the members necessary to form a quorum, rendering it useless. What formed in its place was called the Provincial Conference of Committees, which gave clear instructions that the delegates should vote for independence. Although there had been that connection, wanted or not, between independence and the formation of a republic, it is important to realize that the colonies did not necessarily grant that power. While there was widespread support for independence, the colonies all explicitly made clear that they reserved the right over their own systems of government. This was much to the disappointment of more radical revolutionaries, men like Thomas Paine, who had far grander views, which still caused many throughout the colonies a considerable amount of anxiety. Pauline Meyer, who we have obviously leaned heavily on today, points out that this question of power sharing between the federal government and the individual colonies, which were soon to become states, would remain long into the future. Surviving through the Constitutional Convention, and then further out into the crisis leading to the Civil War, this struggle within the power balance would prove to be a major feature of American politics, and is indeed one that we are going to return to often. This process repeated itself throughout the colonies from north to south. Although there had been some bumps in the road, the radicals had won. Throughout the colonies, moving down to the local county level, people had come to the conclusion that there could not be, nor should there be, reconciliation with the British. That the only option for the future of the colonies was to be separate and independent from Great Britain. On June the 7th, 1776, after a morning filled with debates, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia, following his instructions from just a few weeks earlier, rose and made the following motion: that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are abolished from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is, and ought to be, totally dissolved. That it is expedient forthwith to take the most effectual means for forming foreign alliances. That a plan of confederation be prepared and transmitted to the respective colonies for their consideration and approbation. More than a year after the first shots of the war were fired, the colonies were now prepared to make their position clear. Going all the way back to our episodes on the Dominion of New England, we have kept asking that central question: what is the role of the North American British colonies in the Greater British Empire? It has been a question that has been at the core of everything that we have spent our time here doing, and one that had been asked tens of thousands of times during the preceding decades. Now, Richard Henry Lee has suggested an answer to that question, one that will be confirmed a little under a month later. The colonies had no role in the Greater British Empire. Next time, the Continental Congress will take up the monumental task of deciding if the time is right to declare their independence from Great Britain. Until then, I hope you all have a wonderful 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time, as the colonists make their most radical move yet and declare their independence.